And you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Derry or at The Dr. Derry. That's D-R-D-E-R-Y.
To see and share our amazing animations and find out more information about us, the show, as well as links to our social media, go to noisefiltershow.com.
We are grateful to our sponsors, including Access Health Louisiana and the End the Epidemic Initiative, who are working to bring equitable health outcomes to everyone they serve. Hope, any last words?
Stay well out there, folks, and continue taking steps to keep yourself and your loved ones healthy. That includes exercise, a good diet, getting adequate sleep, and seeing your healthcare providers regularly.
And protect yourself and others by getting the COVID-19 vaccine and booster, wearing a mask, and social distancing wherever possible. Remember, health is a human right.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
There's something missing and I'm late. Got something to say. Oh yeah. All of the witches and the demons better get out my way.
Good evening and welcome to Transpositive PDX here on KBOO. We are joined this evening by our regular host Emma Lugo, and
hello, thank you.
And Sheila Mankart, who is a regular guest. I am Jean, and I go by she and her pronouns. So Emma and Sheila, please, you know, introduce yourselves and your pronouns.
Oh, okay. I'm Sheila, and she and her pronouns are just fine for me.
So this evening, we're just going to have a general conversation around issues which affect the transgender population in, you know, general, and maybe even touch on some other stuff that is peripheral. But it's always a fascinating conversation when we have Sheila on. She's extremely well-read and informed, as is Emma. And so I'd like to go ahead and open by simply asking Sheila, what's on your mind?
In the past month or so, there was a documentary. I can't remember the exact organization that sponsored it, but essentially what he did is he tried to go around and ask people to answer the question, what is a woman? And of course, the whole purpose of it was to say that if you can't define something, the subtext is that it should be so obvious that to not answer the question is to already have been victimized by cross-gender propaganda, or alternatively, that you would be forced to the more common affirmations in prior eras, prior to when we became aware of gender dysphoria and its prevalence and how many people and many how they address this topic in their lives. And so I thought maybe we could kind of address that question a little bit and tonight and talk about how we see that question if we were simply interviewed and asked that question.
Well, okay. I was trying to conjure the name of the person that did that little documentary. It's Matt something. And yeah, that was about, I don't know, a month or 6 weeks ago. And I did watch, you know, a big piece of it. And it's, you know, clearly been edited and you know, produced to create an effect which causes one to come away with a doubt or whatever, a doubt about not about what is a woman, but a doubt about those of us who identify as women without, I guess, whatever the dominant cultural definitions. I mean, it was clearly an anti-trans documentary. And so, yeah, I watched it, Sheila, and I came away with two feelings. First of all, of course, it's outrage. It's outrage. And then secondly, I came away feeling very challenged with trying to articulate exactly how I would answer the question in that documentary, especially on a spur of the moment, because this guy was just asking people on the street, you know, with no forewarning or anything, and then utilizing their surprise and their, you know, challenged, you know, reflection, because it's a deep question. It's a deep question. So, you know, what do you think about it, Sheila?
Well, I think he meant it to be something so trivial that the only way you could squirm out of it was to buy into an agenda that was denying common sense. But let's actually take it seriously for a minute here. And one of the things is to look at some of the answers that did come up. One of the things was chromosome makeup. You have a double X chromosome. If you have a double X, you're a woman. If you have an XY, you're a man. But of course, that leaves out Klinefelter syndrome, which is, I believe, triple sex Y. And it leaves out Turner syndrome, which is X0, which means one X chromosome, and there is no X or Y. It leaves out androgen insensitivity syndrome, which is the inability to read the testosterone cues, even though the person may be XY. And so the fact that it would immediately fail the chromosome test right off of the bat, because someone who has Klinefelter syndrome, you would say, well, if you have two X's, well, you've got a woman, but if you have an XY and that's there too, well, then you are technically, so you're both, would be the only logical answer under the chromosome test. But that doesn't necessarily square with the experience of someone who has Klinefelter syndrome. So they'd say, well, that it doesn't help to disprove a rule by bringing up the few exceptions. I say, well, there's not that few. The intersex conditions are fairly common. And I said, the mere fact that you are trying to universalize it, that you're saying there's only male and only female, means that one exception can disprove your rule. And so automatically what started as a snotty, simplistic question immediately becomes complicated on the purely physiological level. But let's say that we go somewhere else and you say, well, a woman is someone who bears ovaries and a uterus. There again, we have a problem, because what if someone's had a hysterectomy, or what if someone has some other type of birth defect that interferes with them having a fully functional uterus? What if it's a matter of fertility? Does it mean that you have to have had a child before you're a woman? What about those who never have children? And what if someone is postmenopausal? Does that mean somehow their womanhood has been compromised by the sheer fact of aging? So once again, we end up with a very complicated definition. But what if they say, well, what about the gender ideology movement, where it appears to be gender assignment on demand? And I say, well, that's not, you obviously haven't read anything then. I'd be speaking to that person. Because if you had read anything about the clinical literature of transgender treatment, you would know that it requires quite often extensive examination of how people feel and how long they've felt this way. And even then, there's no clear-cut, uniform belief that absolutely everyone has to go on hormones, or absolutely everyone has to have gender reassignment surgery. Or confirmation surgery. Yeah. That is not necessarily the truth. So all of a sudden, his simplistic question becomes complicated, but the thing that was really there was that it was a rider. It was the assumption that if you're not, quote, a woman, then you can't claim the prerogatives and prerequisites of being a woman. And what I'd like to address in depth tonight is precisely, what is it? If you are a man or a woman, what are the bonus package? What do you get once the assignment has been made?
Oh my goodness. That's okay. Well, I'm really fascinated to hear what you have to say about that. But before we, you know, dive into that, I just want to make this observation. As much of an activist, as much of my lived experience and everything, it's really, really difficult to engage with some of these deeper levels of argument and debate, because I keep falling back to, it's because that's how I identify, and it just doesn't seem to carry enough weight in the society, you know. And because it doesn't carry weight in the society, it doesn't seem to, you know, extend to political power or anything like that. We just seem to be so inherently disadvantaged. And nobody talks about that. not in the media, not in the political forums, not in any of that. So, you know, here we are with the patriarchy. It's like, I just keep going around in circles, and there's no gotcha, stop the whole argument, debate, point to counter this turf or just, you know, right-wing perspective that, you know, we're talking about with this Matt whoever and his documentary. I'm sorry for the rant here, but it's almost like we got almost no ammunition in our, you know, on our side. It's so hard to counter some of these arguments.
Well, one of the things is that there is an asymmetry in the way that we penalize in divergent ways the direction that people are identifying. Here's some of the things that I've observed just in all the groups kind of that I've, you know, participated in through the years. I think there's a subtle sense that transgender people going from male to female are being motivated by either what was called for a while autogynephilia, the desire to simply participate in femininity without actually having that a valid metaphysical category that they're entitled to. And so there was a thought that we've got to protect our quote female only space because anyone who's been tainted by maleness is going to carry that aggressive tendency and that desire, what they used to call the male gaze, G-A-Z-E, into the locker room with them. Forgetting, of course, that there are lesbian women who are already in the locker room, and it also implies that there's no corresponding fear in the high school boys' locker room. And I'd say, well, why is that? Is there something innately aggressive about young men that we are basically afraid of? If that's the fear, then why don't we simply address our fear of maleness, that there's no such thing as maleness that could be kept under control, and that male sexual urges are not so insistent that open the door a tiny little bit and all of a sudden there'll be this giant flood of rabid young men that are attacking girls in locker rooms. It's just preposterous.
Sheila, we also, I mean, when you bring up that topic, which I know is really, it's a really touchy subject, like we also have to talk about the complicated history of autogynephilia as a label, a pejorative label used against trans women, because we'll start with this base assumption that there's something about transgender people that's fundamentally a lie, that's fundamentally deceptive, and that there's another psychological agenda, and that explains all of the complicated experience of trans identity. So it's autogynephilia is something that was created by people who don't like transgender people, who are trying to explain away transgender people, particularly transgender women, by giving them this label that was used for a long time to try to somehow explain or to rationalize that transgender people are basically just perverts who have some sort of psychological problem. This is a deep-rooted psychological problem, they believe, of transgender people, and that they're basically just perverts. And it's extremely harmful. And it basically portrays us as something that we're not. I mean, transgender women are women. I mean, they're born with, from the time that we're as young as we can remember, we're born with an identity that is female. So, unfortunately, transgender people get layered with all of these cultural accretions that are put on top of our authentic identity. And a lot of those cultural accretions are put upon us against our will. And autogynephilia is one of those labels that we're that gets stuck on us. And even though it's no longer politically acceptable to say that in public, that's still something that most people think in private. Thank you for letting me say
that.
Yeah.
You're so welcome with that. Because one thing, Jean, on that, there's a strange, you hit it when you said that they dished that out on the transgender community. What we're in denial of is that as a society, we have fetishized the female body. And that's why we have a Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. And for instance, that is confined to young women. I have so far never seen a Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue that has young guys in on a beach somewhere. So this is just an example of how we take the female body and we parse it out as a commodity every day in advertising, to a degree that's much more than we do with the male body, in spite of the fact that there are sometimes very good GQ models or things like that. It's different. And then the assumption is to appropriate that is to somehow, it's like trying to basically raid somebody's little, it's like we're all Mr. Potato Head and there's all these little paste on parts, and that we could all go running into the dollar store and grab as many of the little parts, and if we get enough of them together in us, then we'll say, okay, well, you're a woman or you're a man, dependent on that. And the reason that we don't have some similar anxiety from female to male trans people is because we also fetishize maleness in a way that involves power. And the idea is, once a woman, you are all sort of doomed to powerlessness. So the message being set out there is that no matter what you do, you can never be a real man. And similarly, no matter what you do, you can never be a real woman. And that's how we treat people who are trying to become authentic in their own portrayal of who they are.
Okay, so I'm going to drop a great big mess in the middle of the table here. What part of everything that we have said thus far in this conversation has not been expressed every which way from Sunday for many years? Is there anything new in this conversation? Is there anything new? I'm just gonna say that. Is there anything new? Anybody got anything new to say?
Well, Jean, what do you expect from a bunch of old trans women?
Well, this is the challenge, though, Emma. We've had the same narrative for years, and it gained us, under certain circumstances, some progressions in terms of understanding and stuff in the broader society. And it's gained us a tremendous amount of benefits, at least in the West Coast, East Coast, certain states, those kinds of things. But, you know, in the medical community, granted, but it's still this.
So, Jean, do you mean
narrative.
Is there?
It's still
so
the
Jean,
same
do you
narrative.
Mean is there new thinking? I mean, like, I mean, the new thinking is coming from the younger people. A lot of the new thinking is like queer as an umbrella term to kind of describe like really queer as an identity in and of itself. Like, I mean, I'll tell you some of the things that are new. I mean, and you know this, Jean, because sometimes you sit down in interviews with me. It's super common for me nowadays to sit in on a conversation with a bunch of younger queer people, and they'll be like, oh, I'm trans, and I'm non-binary, and I'm gender fluid. And I'm like, what? How does that work? And they're like, and then they explain it, and they're like, well, this is what it means. And they're like, they've got to figure it out. I mean, I don't understand it, but they've got to figure it out. And it's like, it's more sophisticated. I mean, it's more sophisticated. And at the same time, there's also like old school trans people coming, being born every day. And there's like all these other things. I mean, what's changed in the last 20 years, at least, is this, you know, rainbow of gender expression. Like it used to just be like you were either a man or a woman. And if you transitioned, you went from one to the other. And now it's like there's like 46 different genders. So that's changed.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yes, Emma. And clearly, I'm still alive and I'm still paying attention. So I understand exactly what you're saying. The point being here, where I think we started this conversation, is how does a person's identity translate into a sociological, political, legal context? Okay? How do we interpret this? In a set and setting that has always been so binary.
There's where being an older trans person is a certain advantage, because in the days when I was first addressing this issue, it was really clear that the gatekeeping process was so strict that it's sort of like the category was so discreet that the idea was that transitioning should be a credit to the people doing the assignment. And so in a way, what they did is they kind of sifted through a lot of trans people who today would have no problem getting on hormones or doing just about anything they wanted. And they would sift out the Miss Americas and the young people and people that would, quote, do credit to the whole concept that you could transition genders. And so it was like auditioning for a beauty pageant. And I won't say that everybody had to be beautiful, but they had to be at least, quote, passable. And that was the goal, passableness. Whereas now the goal is authenticity, regardless of how you appear or even how you declare. And that's in some ways very liberating, but that's the thing that's freaking out a lot of the people that are very conservative, because they say that's the relativity that we feel that, and there's where the religious angle comes in to say, well, if God assigns sexes and the world and the entire family structure depends upon a male-female polarity somewhere in the mix, well, that we don't want relativity. And we thought we were being generous granting a few exceptional little exception passports in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. But now it's gotten so transgender might be temporary, and then that brings in that whole anxiety continuum of, well, how much do we want the sexes to be able, or do we have to share restrooms? I mean, and that's what, and see, for people that are older that still have the idea, hey, we're so few and we're so clinical that you don't need to worry about us. We're not even very political. We just want to live our lives. That model has been broken down to all of a sudden we're seeing like this cross-gender tidal wave that's going to drown everybody in cross-genderism. And that's why they're trying to get back to the good, quote, good old days, forgetting that a lot of transgender folk are like the good old days too, when we could just go about our business and not be up in the firing line every day on every political debate.
Yes, and I completely identify with the point that you just made. I am a binary transgender person. I am a woman. I live as a woman. I function in the world as a woman. I experience as much of that as I guess I can, you know, justify. But what just conjured in my mind as you were, you know, saying all of that, hun, is I'm going back, Emma, to the very first trans march that we organized you and I and others, what was that, 2014, 2015 in Portland. And the signs that I made and carried in that march were, there were two signs. I had one in each hand. One of them said, all gender is fluid. And the other one was, trans rights are simply human rights. Simply human rights. It doesn't matter what gender you identify, where on the spectrum you identify. As a human being, we should theoretically, ethically, morally, be entitled to equal rights. The fact is, though, in our lived experience and in this culture and in cultures all over the world, there's still a dichotomy. There is a binary. And we keep bouncing up against that. And unfortunately, we've been used as a political football. We can't talk about the real issues. We end up talking about, you know, somebody, you know, on a swimming team or riding bicycle in competition or bathrooms. And it's, you know, and we all know in this conversation that that's all baloney, excuse my language, but that's, we're still stuck in this quagmire.
Here's a question that I would pose to people who supposedly do not have gender dysphoria of any sort. And I think maybe our community could reach out and say, turn the tables for a change and say, do you ever find, since you, let's say that someone identifies and says, no, I've never doubted my gender. I have no problem living my gender. And I'm just fine with that. In fact, I think it's a blessing that I have my gender exactly the way I identify. I'd say, well, that's what we're looking for too. But I said, let's just talk about it. Do you ever feel a little pinching in the shoe? Do you ever? And they say, well, I've never wanted to walk around in high heels. And I say, well, but how about do you get tired of being strangled by a tie every single day around your neck, and that your clothing, you know, is seems, it's almost always, you know, a question, do you want navy blue, powder blue, or black? I mean, would you like a little variety there somewhere? And they say, well, it's not a matter of sartorialness. That's not where I feel it. I guess what I'd like is to feel that I don't feel the responsibility of being the paterfamilias who have to provide so much of the solidity of the family, because I get frightened too. And if I started to cry, my family would look at me like, oh my God, our world is falling apart. Our father is crying, you know. And meanwhile, a woman might say, well, once in a while, I'd like to be able to get extremely angry without being read as shrill or bitchy. And so I think everyone would admit that we have kind of, we've dealt out all the cards of gender into two opposing camps, and everybody every once in a while looks across the fence and says, you know, I'd like some hearts and diamonds instead of spades and clubs for a change. And when you look at the fact of the real world, where in point of fact, sometimes people have profoundly divergent hands. What if they took that as the model to say, instead of trying to find where the dividing line is and then hammer it home, what if they took the idea, like you have 52 cards in the deck and they deal them out, and you pick them up and you look at your hand and say, oh my God, where's my flushes? Where's my, you know, where's my straights, you know, and straights in two ways, you know, and like, how do I fit into the world? Why are we so harsh with young women in terms of cyberbullying? Of you know, what if I'm treated differently depending upon my immediate sexuality at puberty as a young woman? And what if, as a young man, the whole thing is to sign some way to not appear to be gay, and to find these little, these little brownie, not brownie points, I'm using, see, I can't help it, be trans person, little merit badges of saying, do I qualify yet as a male?
Yeah, you've really said a lot there, Sheila. I mean, I think that what you're getting at is what are the cultural expectations of men and women in our society? And, you know, it's like in the queer world, we can have these really broad conversations where we can sort of gender bend and be gender fluid, and we can say all kinds of things. But in the world of most heteronormative people, there's this culturally implicit identity that belongs to your gender. And that's like this reality for like so many people in this country.
And they vote, and their representatives are the ones that are enacting these, you know, transphobic, you know, things in different states. I mean, that is reality. I don't know how to phrase it. There's what's ethically, morally, spiritually right in terms of a human being's right to be who they are. And then there's everything else. And, you know,
That's part of why, like, if you do anything that challenges that, it kind of makes you queer. I mean, even if you're a radical feminist, it kind of makes you queer in a way if you're doing something that challenges the culturally heteronormative expectations of our society.
Yeah.
And I think that for a lot of us, I mean, like you were saying, Sheila, I mean, wouldn't it be nice sometimes to, you know, not feel the burden of just being expected because of your gender to be the caregiver or to be the provider? I mean, to be the dominant or the sub, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, to be the giver or to be the one who receives. I mean, there's this idea about an exchange of power that's at the heart of so much of this. And this is why I'm a feminist. Not all trans women are feminists,
yes.
But I'm hardcore feminist because
yes.
I understand that this is about power. It's about the dynamics of power in a patriarchal society. And I have always been like against the patriarchy since like 5962 BC.
Yes.
You know, I'm
yeah.
like the patriarchy is public enemy number one in my dictionary. And that's why I'm a feminist. But being a feminist is not the same thing to me as being a transgender woman. I mean, my identity as a woman is something that came to me when I was, you know, before I was even conscious of the world. I mean, when I was,
yes,
before I was five, I thought
yes.
I was a girl, and I thought
yes.
I was going to grow up with a girl's life.
Or that's what I dreamed of, at least. And that's what I was subjugated over.
Yeah.
You know, and then, you know, browbeaten, and I won't go into that, but Sheila, I want to make this observation in this conversation. I've had multiple conversations with you, and what I know or have come to know about you is that you are a trained theologian. You have you know, tremendous depth and training in that arena. And I observe this in this conversation. You continue to, I think, come from an ethical position based on your theological and spiritual beliefs, and I appreciate that. And where we seem to keep meeting in the middle is the big, as illustrative of everything that's going on in the United States, maybe in the UK, maybe, you know, maybe in, you know, a lot of the English speaking, you know, world right now, you know, Australia, all kinds of places, politically, is this contention between the ethical, theological, religious perspectives on some of these questions and the political side of all of this, the sociological, political side of all of this. And, you know, maybe that's why, you know, we're having what sounds almost like a contentious, you know, debate in this conversation, because Lord knows, I know that all three of us in this conversation, you know, are sisters. But anyway, it's, I tend to come from a, you know, what can I actually do? What can I actually, you know, what's realistic in terms of what do I sense that I can actually accomplish versus what's in my, you know, ethical, moral, you know, scale, what's right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've got some thoughts on all these things. When I wrote my book, I wanted to have total clarity. And what I realized in the writing of the book is that there was no escaping conflict. And that was my truth. And the desire to seek clarity was the very thing that was messing things up. And what I really realized was that, like any life course, I'd had certain unfortunate experiences that, like trying to get total control over these feelings was really hard for me. But in some respects, there were periods when I could kind of make this go away for a while, and I could kind of just shove it under the thing or just say it's impossible or I'm not, you know. And then other times when it would be so insistent that I don't think I really had a clear and even choice on it. Now, as I'm older and have kind of seen everything and participated in the different levels of our community, I look at it and saying, maybe I'm freer now than I was then. But that's part of being an older person, is that you look back on the things that determine your career choice, who you dated, who you married, all the things that you did in your life, and you look and you say, you know, a lot of this was, I kind of got off on blue highways instead of being on the big interstate where a lot of people seem to spend their whole lives. And you think, well, why is it so hard for me, and why is it so much easier for other people? And then if you've literally lived on both sides, it's almost like you create a safety zone for each side of your own personality. And it becomes a set of life skills. Like if I want to get help with something, I can go into my helpless female mode and I can get all kinds of little goodies, and people are there rescuing me at a moment's notice. And then afterwards I look at myself and I said, I thought you were a really competent person, and how come you do you know, little lost weight so well? And I think, well, because in a lot of my life I was a little lost waif. I say, yeah, but you were also sometimes super competent and the person to go to for help. So like, which is the real you? Will that real you stand up? And I say, well, no, because they're both true. And what do you do with things like that? And the difference is that the straight world is always trying to draw a nice tough line between the two. And in, quote, queer society, divergence is not only not sanctioned, it's actually sometimes approved of. And Holly Woodlawn said one time, they said, well, somebody came up and asked her the question, said, well, are you a man or a woman? Just, you know, and she said, what difference does it make as long as you look fabulous? And I always thought that was not only cute, but I thought it was true. I thought from her point of view, the important thing was just having an enjoyable and personally authentic life. Now, there's a price for that. I've never married. I don't have any children. There's times when I look at people that are grandparents and you watch the spring of life going on. I think, well, did I miss all that because I was transgender, or maybe I would have remained single anyway? But that's where the religious element comes in, because part of the structure of the Christian concept, at least of that I was exposed to of the family, is that complementarity not only provides a balance and an ideal environment for raising children, but it allows each party to move freely at their side of the badminton net and not get all tangled up in the net, and everything just works okay. But on the other hand, anyone that's ever gone to marriage counseling knows that that's somewhat of an illusion, because a lot of times it's precisely these very strict gender roles that make heterosexual marriages fail. So there's a lot to be said about all of them.
You know, what that makes me think of, Sheila, is it kind of brings me back around to the beginning of our conversation about what is a woman. You know, I mean, is a woman someone who's the nurturer? Is that what a woman is? Is a woman the person who does the dishes? You know, is that what a woman is? Is a woman the person who puts their career second behind their family and their husband? Is that what a woman is? You know, as trans people, as transgender women, is that what we want? Because we're usually told, we're told from the time that we transition to be prepared to live your life as a woman. And for most women, what that means is be ready to play second fiddle to men. You know, be ready to step into a world like the kind that we've just stepped into, where women are suddenly told, because of your biology, you don't have the same rights as men. There's something about you that gives you less rights than a man. And we're told that's the kind of world that we need to expect to live in. So is that what it means to be a woman?
Well, I can tell you experientially something that I've noticed now more than ever before. Is I find so much heroism in women, and so much of a stand up and get involved and be there for other women, that I'm blown away by it. I find myself saying, I don't want this to be taken wrong, but I find myself saying, I'm so honor the strength that I see in women around me, that I look at my own self and I say, I don't deserve this. I don't know if I'm as generous. I don't know if I'm this giving, this perceptive. Part of being raised as a male is that you're kind of allowed to have your, you know, kind of to be a little bit spoiled in a way. You get to say, well, you know, I can kind of have it my way, and I don't really have to, you know, if you even just go to an average church and you say, well, who's volunteering to wash the dishes? And I won't say that the men never do, but in almost anything where something needs to be done, women are right there volunteering, and they're totally involved, and they're helping other women raise their children, and they're just doing such great things. And I'm very proud of women. And I also think that there's a graciousness at every age of a woman's life, that there's something almost more complete. I sort of feel kind of sorry for guys sometimes, because I feel like there's almost a maiming there. And then when you see that most of these shootings are done by young men at exactly age 18 to 21, right after they graduate from high school and don't know where they're going to go or what they're going to do, I look at that and I say, well, do you need any further evidence to realize how hard it is to be a young man in this society and how few people are out there trying to help them find their ground, get a little bit of a foothold in life before determining that they're going to not only kill themselves, but end up taking a lot of other people with them?
You know, that's a great point, Sheila. I mean, I think that for those of us who transitioned later in life, like maybe we transitioned after puberty, maybe even after we were 18, because I know that nowadays a lot of younger trans women can transition, you know, they can begin social transition when they're still in grade school and in high school, which I think is amazing, even if they're not doing medical transition until later.
Thank goddess.
Yeah,
but for
those of us who transitioned after high school, after college, or later in life, we've had a chance to see the world from both a man's perspective and a woman's perspective. And I think what you raised, Sheila, is like, I have so much empathy for how hard it is in this world for young men. I mean, men need a lot of nurturing. They need a lot of emotional support that they're not getting. Men are raised to be something inhuman, I think, is really how I put it. I mean, they're raised to be something that's not authentically human. And it creates so many problems because they're raised to be violent, they're raised to be domineering, they're raised to be bullies. The race to be out of touch with their emotions. I mean, there's so many problems with the way that young men are raised in our culture. And I think that for those of us who, you know, have always been women, but happen to have the unfortunate experience of living with men for a lot of our lives, we understand that really well. So thank you for raising
exactly.
that, Sheila.
Well, you're welcome. Another thought that flows out of this is, let's say that I had that guy that did the film in front of me, and I'd say, you know, rather than making a film asking superfluous questions that's not really going to get you anywhere anyway, because you're going to end up with a kind of, even if you have a definition, it doesn't determine that once that definition is there, certain rights or privileges are going to attach to it. So suppose we did this. Suppose we just said, what do you guys want and what do we want? And I'd say, well, since I'm transgender, I get to go first. And so I'd say, okay, well, number one, don't kill us, right? So that would already eliminate a lot of the problems that are going on out there, that transgender people are killed regularly. Number two, don't sexually exploit us. Don't use us as fetish objects, and don't use us for purely sexual purposes. Number three, be willing to employ us, give us a decent job, don't hold our identity against us, even assuming that this is some sort of a maiming and that we don't meet the criteria of looking the way you would like us to look, even assuming that for a minute, can't you employ us? Can't you give us a place to live? Can't you make our lives as easy as you possibly can? And they say, well, no, there's where we're starting to have problems, because if we make it easy for you, you'll never find your way back to the way God wants you to be. And I'd say, well, but let's just assume that God will take care of that, okay? Is it your job to make my life sufficiently miserable? Would you adapt that to anything else? You know, and they say, well, that's part of tough love. That's why we have prisons. If you make things obnoxious enough, then people will follow the straight and narrow. I say, well, they don't seem to, do they? Because they'll look at their prison recidivism and look at the fact that we have more people in jails in America per capita than any other country in the world, and we're supposedly more free than anyone else. So apparently the punitive model is not working, and threatening us with burning forever in hell isn't going to work either, because it doesn't seem to have. People live their way they want to live. So I said, why don't you try a thing of attraction? If you really want to come over that way, but don't make our lives miserable. And I think if we put it that way and we just said, let's just cut to the chase here. Don't make fun of us. Don't laugh at us. Don't yell at names at us. Wouldn't that have made my own transition an awful lot easier if I'd just gotten those four little fairly brownie points? And isn't that a more civilized approach than to go after and try to make people's lives miserable and say, we're doing it for your own good?
Oh my God, that was beautifully articulate in the moment. It was incredible. Here's my debate counterpoint. How does that agenda affect a cishet perspective? See, that's where we bump up against. It seems so simple when we look at it from a human rights perspective. We're not asking for special privileges. It's not special privileges. This is what, you know, I don't know, 97% of the population enjoys. We're not asking for special. We're just asking for equal. And, you know, the thing is that there's this stick point. How does what we're asking for infringe in their minds upon their comfort zones?
Well, their comfort zone is that, in point of fact, they are not that comfortable. Because if it was all as easy as they said, and it didn't take such intense training to adapt to a societally imposed gender role, then they shouldn't be surprised. It'd be like having a car manufacturer and say, well, you know, don't you ever have a certain number of people that cars that vary a little bit? Maybe something didn't come out. But does that mean that it's bad? Is it still within the specs? Is that something that you can still live a decent human life? Do you want to just trash it and just, you know, in other words, how do you ever just trash people? How do you ever take anybody in this world and say, you don't deserve to be here? You're an atrocity. And I said, and all you have to do if you're a person that's major anti-trans is just say, just look at your language. Look at the hatefulness. Look at the fear that's manifested in the way that you approach us. Why don't you just, whatever happened to just basic curiosity, but not intrusive curiosity, but one that says, why don't you just hang around with us for a while and realize who we are and realize how many commonalities there are. And then you won't be afraid of us and you won't be angry at us either. You'll just say, oh my God, people, huh, interests, qualifications, a lot of people that could contribute a lot. What about the days when we're all being kicked out of the service? And the cost of the military of losing all that wonderful talent that was representative in the trans community. And, you know, and the idea that we're part of the decadence of modern culture, I want to say, sorry, but it's kind of the other way around. If you look at theater, if you look at many of the creative arts, you're going to find so many LGBT people there. And to take them out would be to lose Walt Whitman. It would be to lose a lot of very, very talented people.
What a wonderful way to bring this whole conversation back around to at least a logical point. Because what you just illustrated there is education, experience. I mean, being out there, giving people lived experiences to understand us, etc. That is the mission. That's how we have made progress. And I don't, you know, it's like, it's not gonna give answers immediately, but education and how we interact with other folks is what's going to move us forward.
Great, that's a great ending. Do you wanna kind of close out the show, Jean?
Yeah, you've been listening to Trans Positive PDX on KBOO, Portland, Oregon. This show is an open forum in community radio that allows conversation, you know, on the topics that affect transgender folks in this society. And we appreciate if you listened to the show. Thank you so much. Good night.
Transgender people don't live here.
I've never met anyone who's transgender.
I swear I don't know someone who's transgender.
Transgender and non-binary people like me hear this all the time.
But according to the HRC Foundation, there are more than 2 million transgender people in the United States.
We live in every community across this country.
You might be surprised to hear that there are more transgender and non-binary people in the United States than there are
Starbucks,
McDonald's, and Walmart locations combined.
In fact, if you put us all together,
there'd be more non-binary and transgender folks than the populations of DC,
or Nebraska,
or Maine,
or Idaho,
or West Virginia.
As a matter of fact, 15 states have a lower population than the amount of trans folks in the U.S.
So here are a few things to keep in mind.
You don't always know when a person is trans.
But we're your neighbors.
Your co-workers.
Your students.
Your customers.
And even your friends and family.
We exist in every culture, todas las culturas, throughout human history.
And while we're more visible than ever before,
sometimes you just don't see us.
So when you hear about politicians pushing for discriminatory bills,
know this, these bills address problems that aren't even real.
Problems that don't actually exist.
But we do.
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 We do.